The Howard County Orchestra is celebrating 40 years of music making, but things weren't always all glamorous as they are today.
Orchestra was started 40 years ago. It started out as a tiny little string orchestra. I think some of their early rehearsals were in people's homes, and it was just kind of a way for some of the local musicians to get to keep playing.
And if you've ever second-guessed yourself thinking you can't make a difference volunteering your time and helping children out, you might want to reconsider.
You don't need to be anything special. I mean, it so happens that we do have a lot of retired educators who want to do this. It's sort of their opportunity after years of teaching or whatever to like have this one-on-one with a student. But we have folks from all different kinds of backgrounds, and it doesn't matter.
These stories coming up in today's episode of HOCO Journal, starting right now. Hi, and welcome to HOCO Journal, the show where we highlight the unique and interesting people, businesses, nonprofit organizations, and events happening right here in Howard County. I am your host, Cris Oviedo. Children are the future of our world, and where society goes in the next few decades, it's literally in their hands. That's why I am a firm believer that providing kids with the best possible education and giving them access to the right resources and support is crucial so that when they grow up and take over, their decisions will be well-founded and have positive outcomes for all of humanity. That's why supporting and keeping alive foundations like AOK is key in our community. And it is with great pleasure that I introduce you to my guest for today, Susan Berger, and she is the executive director at AOK Mentoring and Tutoring. How are you doing today?
I'm great.
Thank you for coming into our studio to talk about AOK Mentoring. And if you're not familiar with AOK Mentoring, get ready because we are about to dive right into it and get all the details. So let's start from the beginning.
Okay.
What is AOK Mentoring?
Okay, so AOK Mentoring is a school-based mentoring and tutoring program in Howard County. The program's been around for over 12 years. It was incorporated in 2009. And it basically started with folks wanting to work one-on-one with students in the school to help out. What it's evolved into is, you know, there are mentoring programs all over the county and everywhere. And one of the things that makes AOK unique is that it's a school-based program. So what it's all about is volunteers who are assigned to one child in a school who they meet with on an individual basis once a week, same day, same time every week for the duration of the school year. And they really, it's all about them forming a relationship with the student to help support the student in any way that they can.
So going off that idea of meeting with the student, what's the main goal of this one-on-one experience?
Okay, so it sort of comes out of the idea that there are lots of great, great things about Howard County Public Schools, and students with lots of challenges get lots of services. But there are a lot of students that fall through the cracks because they don't have anything blaringly wrong about them.
Nothing
but
that fits into a category.
But yeah, so they are the kids that sometimes just, for whatever reason, need a little more adult attention. And so that's the goal, is to give them that attention. And sometimes that's directed by the classroom teacher, who can identify certain challenges that he or she has with the student that might be something to focus on. Sometimes it has to do with the guidance counselor in the school and identifying that the student may have some social skill issues or behavioral issues. Again, things that are typically under the radar. So it's a very individualized thing, and every volunteer is doing something different and addressing something different than the next volunteer.
And I love that you brought that up, because on your website you guys have academics, behaviors, social skills, and self-esteem.
Yeah.
So You guys are a volunteer-driven organization. You guys have a very small staff. From what I saw on your website, 4 people.
Actually, 2.
So even less than what I saw. Yeah. And everybody else is a volunteer. How do you guys go about, you know, when you have all these needs that you guys are tending to, how do you guys go into that process of focusing when it's academics, well, we have this pool of volunteers, and when it's behaviors, we have this, like, how do you work that out?
Okay, so first of all, I mean, as an organization, we provide some supports and direction for the volunteers. So before they even meet a student, they've gone through some training and some like one-on-one interview with a volunteer, a former volunteer, so that they're really kind of prepared for what they might encounter. But what the research shows and what our experience is, and is sometimes hard for volunteers to grasp, is mm-hmm. that kids will do better academically if they have a mentor. Period. No matter what that, well, obviously under certain restraints, but no matter what that mentor does with the student, that relationship, and by virtue of it being kind of one-on-one individual time just for that kid, the kid does better. We don't have a lot of capacity to actually measure that, but research shows that all over the place. And in fact, volunteers who volunteer and mentor in the school do affect academics more than a mentor in a community program. So, and again, it's not that the volunteers are necessarily sitting there and tutoring the student on how to do their math. There may be a time when a teacher will say to one of our volunteers, you know, Jimmy's having trouble with this assignment, you know, can you take a little time to work with him on that? But generally, it's not as if the volunteer needs to be prepared with lesson plans when they go in to meet with their student, because it really, you know, again, the research shows mentoring has a better effect on the kids when they can direct what it is they want to do or talk about with their mentor. So that's sort of the philosophy we have behind it.
So if we had to paint a picture for a parent who's thinking, okay, well, why would I call you then if you're not going to work with my child on math, you know, because my child is struggling here with our history or whatever subject, right? Mm-hmm. Let's paint the picture for them. So what would maybe, is it a 1 hour, that 30 minute, or how long is that session? What does it look like?
Okay, so it's actually typically less than an hour. Some of the students are pulled out of a like minor subject, or if there's some other kinds of activity that go on, but typically they're pulled out of lunch or recess. So it may be a time where they're maybe eating together, maybe doing some stuff. So what it looks like is a time where first the volunteer is just going to establish a relationship with the child and get to know the child. And mm-hmm. and that can be done with lots of different activities or games or books. And then based on really how the child best relates, they're going to kind of use that medium to fill the time. And that time is going to be addressing what it is the student could use some support for. So if the kid is struggling with math, mm-hmm. then it's possible that volunteer may play games that include math even though they don't know it. If the student is struggling with reading or comprehension or word recognition, they may play games or read books or do kinds of activities that where the student's practicing those things without it really being in the classroom. And that's sort of, you know, sometimes students perform much better one-on-one than they do in a group setting. So the volunteer may have a lot more success in kind of getting over some of those humps and hurdles.
Right. And then when we were talking about social skills and self-esteem and behaviors, how are your mentors helping children with those skills?
Well, again, it sort of depends. And particularly for social skills, first, it's about that relationship and how the student is using their skills to develop that relationship, and the kind of the volunteer checking him on, you know, that's a good way to behave with, you know, to get me to enjoy our time together, as opposed to, you know, being impossible. But some of what our volunteers get involved with kids who have social skills challenges, may be doing maybe once every 2 or 3 weeks when they go to visit, having the student invite a friend to come with them and playing a game together or doing some activity. A lot of our volunteers have all kinds of kind of cool, very easy, quick, crafty kinds of things they do. And so all of that is about, let's do that together and see how that works. And there are actually even some schools where the volunteers do lunch bunches. And the guidance counselors do that a lot with students as well, where, you know, the idea is the socialization. For us, it's that identified student that we're really trying to draw out and make things, make him or her behave more appropriately in that kind of setting.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Absolutely. And I can definitely see how that will help a child's self-esteem if he is having this relationship with this one person and he continues to receive that positive feedback. And there's a lot of research on how feedback, either positive or negative, has a huge impact on children. So what are maybe some of the ways that you guys are seeing that what you guys are doing is affecting the children in a positive way?
Well, again, you know, we aren't privy to a lot of data from the school system, even though we are a formal partner of the school system. But what we do and sort of what drives us is at the end of every year, and in fact, this year we're going to be doing it more than just once a year, we give a survey to both the student's teacher and to the student. We ask lots of questions, both programmatically, but also in terms of what they've gotten out of it. And, you know, for the student, it's about, do you like school? Does the mentor help you like school? What do you do with your mentor? What do you like to do? What don't you like to do? And, we've never gotten a negative one, right? Now, maybe there are kids that didn't respond that might have been negative, but typically, you know, there's just a lot of good feelings about themselves and, you know, that this is a person I can trust, this is a person I can talk to, this is a person who listens to me. I like my day, the day that my mentor is coming, I look forward to that day. And the teachers say that all the time. Hmm. That the kids will say, is she here yet? You know, time is it? So, yeah, I mean, it's only anecdotal that we know that it has that kind of an impact.
And, you know, it's funny because you've mentioned earlier that they either miss recess or lunch many times. Mm-hmm. And for them to still, you know, knowing that they're missing recess or that they're missing lunch and still be looking forward to that time.
Yes.
Not very many people, I think, can say that.
Yes. Well, you know, we do, and maybe I didn't say before, that we do primarily work with elementary school children. And I think people have this vision that a kid being pulled out or not being at lunch one day, you know, that there's like they're kind of ostracized. But in fact, you know, there are kids who are jealous that this kid gets to go with this mentor and do fun things.
Right.
So, yeah, it's something that we really find is a good model for the school system.
It sounds like a very special time for the kids.
Yeah.
That's what it sounds like. And it sounds like it takes a lot of special people in order to be volunteers. So can you tell us a little more about what somebody needs as far as like maybe requirements or, I don't know, in order to become a volunteer?
You don't need to be anything special. I mean, it so happens that we do have a lot of retired educators who want to do this. It's sort of their opportunity after years of teaching or whatever to like have this one-on-one with a student. But we have folks from all different kinds of backgrounds, and it doesn't matter. What does matter is that for the most part, our volunteers have to have time during the day. So most of our volunteers tend to be retired folks or people who just have a more flexible daytime schedule. So that's like one sort of requirement. Now, what we also do is that we do provide some volunteers to after school programs. So there are the Black Student Achievement Programs and others that we provide volunteers to who work with students, not necessarily individually, but in small groups during their homework period of the after school time. And that tends to be less mentoring and more tutoring, or homeworking. Mm-hmm. So folks who don't have daytime free tend to gravitate to that opportunity as opposed to during the school day. But anyone who has the availability, we, as part of our partnership with the school system, do all of the screening of the volunteers. So they are fingerprinted, they get a Child Protective Service background clearance, we get references, we do an individual interview, pretty extensive and time-consuming screening process, and then again the three-hour training class prior to them being able to go into the school. So they hopefully, you know, yeah, there are folks who have been in education or maybe human services in some way, you know, certainly have the background to maybe understand kids' family dynamics better or the social situations that these kids come from. But they're basically starting on the same plane in terms of what our program's goals are and what it's all about.
Mm-hmm. And it sounds like time, it's a big issue and a big requirement. So what kind of commitment is necessary in order to become a tutor?
Right. So it's an hour a week or less, depending on what school and what their requirements are. And, you know, theoretically, every week that school is open during the school year. Obviously, volunteers have lives. And unfortunately, things come up in life as well that you don't expect.
Right.
You know, as long as the student is aware that their volunteer may not be there for a week or two, if they're on vacation or, you know, that kind of thing, as long as the school is aware that they're going to be absent, whatever, that's, it happens. But generally, we're asking, you know, if you go to Florida half the year in your retirement, it's probably not a good fit. Mm-hmm. But, you know, if you travel once or twice during the winter for a week or two or three, you know, we can work that out.
That's perfect. That's perfect to know. And so we kind of talked about what's required. It sounds like it's a little bit of an extensive process mm-hmm. when somebody applies. Mm-hmm. And it's going to, in order to become a volunteer. So the school year just started.
Correct.
If somebody still wants to be a volunteer for this school year that has just begun, and they just apply, say, today after they listen to our show, in reality, how soon do you think that they could start tutoring?
Okay, so in reality, what happens is when somebody comes through our website or calls wanting to volunteer, we hold information sessions once a month, sometimes a little more than once a month, particularly this time of the year. Mm-hmm. So that person comes, picks a session that they want to come to, and that's when the whole process begins. So we give them the whole spiel that I'm giving you here and a lot more, and they get a packet with all the screening forms and all the things they need to do, an application, blah, blah, and then the interview gets scheduled and then they come to the training class. So that's sort of the way it goes. Depending on where they are in that cycle when they contact us, it could take a week or two or it could take a month.
Okay.
Right? But we get referrals through the whole, almost the whole school year. So there are times mm-hmm. when we're still assigning new volunteers in March, before spring break. The after spring break seems like it's not really going to be a productive time. But mm-hmm. so you can respond now and still not even, and say, you know, I'm going to be away for a month or I'm taking a class and I can't do it until January, and we can get you in the loop at that time.
Interesting. See, so it's not like you have to sign up before the school year starts. I mean, it sounds like it's an ongoing thing.
Because what happens is it's typically not a parent that is requesting our services. Each school that we're in has a liaison, and it's typically the guidance counselor or an alternative ed teacher, and they identify the students in whatever process they have in their school. Mm-hmm. It could be they have a team meeting or whatever. And so they bring the student to us. They refer the student to us. And they may not identify a kid till halfway through the year to really realize that what the student's struggling with might be helped by having this relationship with a mentor.
And are there any kind of requirements? I know for many programs, you have to have fall within certain financial limits or geographical areas or anything like that. Is there any requirements like that?
Not at all. You know, I think that our students do come from a pretty diverse backgrounds. And when the program started years ago, it was geared towards Title I schools, but we've really expanded. And part of the reason for the expansion is that a volunteer that we get tends to follow a student year after year and keep coming back. In fact, like about 75% of our volunteers come back every year and stay with the same student.
Oh, that's
wonderful.
But
the student may be in a different school. And part of that speaks to the fact that some of our kids may come from families where there's housing instability and they're moving around. But for whatever reason, the volunteer will kind of go. So we've expanded to schools just because one of the kids from one school has moved to another area and has started in a new school. We also do that with middle schools. We typically start with referrals from elementary schools, but when a student moves from
they
fifth
continue
grade
to grow.
To sixth. So we're now in, I don't know, five or six middle schools. Little more challenging in terms of scheduling. High school doesn't really work well with our model. So most of the kids are in elementary or middle. And once we've gotten into the middle schools, there have been counselors there who have made new referrals of middle school age students because they recognize the value to the students who have it. So so we've sort of expanded that way. But there's no, we would be willing to go to any school that wants us, essentially.
Do they just reach out to you guys, or is there a process to apply, or how would that work?
Well, no, it just sort of has, at least I've been with it. This is my beginning of my third year with AOK, and in my experience, it's sort of word of mouth. And, when we know that a student is moving from one school to another, the guidance counselor from the school that we've worked at will put in a call to the one that we're going to kind of talk it up and explain and kind of, hopefully, obviously it needs to get the support of the administration in each school,
right?
The administrators. So, we appeal to the principals first, but we've had a lot of success just moving that way out into the various communities. The program started out very Columbia-based, and now we're in a lot of the Laurel schools and moving up into Elkridge as well.
That's wonderful. Now, when you guys are matching tutors with students, is it based solely on availability, like, the capability of matching schedules, or do you guys know ahead of time some of the needs of the children and try to match that with the tutor that's going?
That's a good question. Yes, we try to get enough information. There's a lot of issues with confidentiality, so we don't always get specifics, but we do ask the counselors, the liaisons in the school, to identify those areas you said you found on the website. Is this behavioral? Is it social skills? Is it, or maybe it's a family issue. We had, one year we had like just a slew of kids who had lost somebody close to them. And those things aren't a checkoff. That's really something we need to understand and know how that has affected the student. So when the referrals come in, hopefully they're indicating something about at least what area we're looking at. And then based on our screening and our interviewing and our training class, getting to know the volunteer and what they've told us, what kind of student they want to work with, what their hope is for the relationship, we will try to match. We try to match as well, obviously, on availability.
Right.
And, some volunteers are fine, like they'll get in the car, they'll drive, it doesn't matter what school they go to. Others want to be in schools in their communities where their kids went. It's really pretty awesome. I mean, we have volunteers who's now has like a grandchild in one of the schools.
That's fantastic.
it's very nice. But we also have realized, and here I am at the community college, so it's most of our volunteers are older, but it doesn't preclude a college student from becoming a volunteer given their availability and their ability to commit for the school year. But we realize that a lot of the volunteers are retired people, shall we say. So we did realize that there's a lot of communities now being built in the area for, independent living,
right,
older adults. And so we've begun to really reach out to those. we also realize that that may be a population that isn't driving anymore. So we have a relationship with NeighborRide so that we sort of have our own little account with them for our volunteers to access so that they can be A-OK volunteers.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, talk about partnerships to make the community even greater. That is fantastic. Now, mostly you said you guys get your students referred within the school system itself. Right. But I know parents are concerned and they're always looking for great services like the one A-OK gives to children. So if there's a parent listening or if they have found your website and they would like more information, can they come directly to you guys and say, my children goes to this school and I'd like for them to receive your services?
Yes. Sometimes it's my response to them might be, particularly if we have a large presence in the school that their child goes to, I might say, go to Miss So-and-so and she will make this happen. If not, then I will make contact with that student's school and the counselor there. And again, the process will come from the school, but it will be based on the fact that mom or dad has requested that.
And then how about private schools? Do you guys offer services in private schools as well?
We don't. I mean, we haven't. We do have one or two students, again, over the last 2 years that I've been with the organization that were in special schools that were different than the public, but within public schools. And, you know, that was able to be worked out. But we haven't gotten into private schools.
Now, you also said before that you guys not only offer the one-on-one, but you also do like group settings. And if I understand this correctly, this is how you guys participate with the BSAP program, the Bridges program, and the Saturday Math Academy.
Right.
Can you tell us a little more about those three and how that works, how you guys work in connection with them?
Right. I would say that our relationship with them is sort of like we're brokers. We're like providing the commodity. We're providing the volunteers. You know, each of those after-school programs has their own coordinators and their own staff. So we provide the volunteers and they work directly with that staff to work out a schedule and really what their activities will be when they're there.
And do you by any chance happen to know where people can go to find out more information about those three programs?
They can come through us. And I'm sure that those programs have other volunteers just from the community. But primarily, their volunteers who come on a regular basis tend to be A-OK volunteers. So, you know, we will make that connection. We keep track of, you know, what's going on there and their hours and that kind of stuff. So
now I know that a program, even though you guys are mostly dependent on volunteers, there's a lot of other things that you guys have to run. Like you said, there's an extensive process just to do the background checks and all that takes money.
Okay.
Where are your funds coming from?
Well, that's a good question. For the last 2 or 3 years, we were fortunate enough to get a grant from the Howard County Local Children's Board. Unfortunately, those funds are directed now in different ways, and they're not supporting this kind of mentoring program as much. So we've lost that funding, which was a tremendous help to us. We do get some community foundation grants. We do get donations from the public. We're not real sophisticated in fundraising. It's a very volunteer-driven organization. You mentioned four people on our website as staff. In fact, it's two, and we're both part-time, and we have no office space. We work from our homes. Our overhead is very low. And we have seasoned volunteers who help with screening and supporting new volunteers. Without that, it would need additional staff support.
Mm-hmm.
So we don't have a huge budget, but we do have expenses, particularly in the screening area, the fingerprinting and stuff. So we are always looking for people who are willing and able to support us financially.
So if anyone who's listening would like to help and donate, what's the best way for them to do that?
You can do that right on the website and through PayPal. The other way is to, you know, get in touch with me, and maybe there are people out there who like to do fundraising kinds of activities and organize things. And again, you know, low on manpower, we could use volunteers to help in that way as well.
Absolutely. So you can volunteer for many, you know, many different ways. Maybe somebody's listening, and I know you talked about the students here at HCC, and maybe they're a little intimidated. They're like, I don't know that I'm ready to go and just deal with children. But, you know, why not step in and help fundraise? Why not step in and help a little bit maybe with the office maintenance and those kind of things? I'm sure there's emails and phone calls that need to be answered. And I know for a fact that students here at HCC are more than capable to do that kind of thing.
Absolutely. And we also, you know, anything, any ideas and energy to help us recruit more volunteers. You know, our volunteers tend to come from the Columbia area. We're expanding to schools outside of Columbia, so we need kind of to find out what's out there to help bring in more people from those areas as well. And if students come from those areas and have some ideas, would be great.
Absolutely. Susan, is there anything else? We're just about ready to wrap our conversation here, but is there anything else that we haven't talked about that you would like to mention to our listeners?
Well, no, I was going to mention the fundraising. not really. I mean, I think that it's, you know, it's just the whole idea of the program was started, really, it was just all volunteer based, all grassroots. It really comes from people who just want to help kids. And if that's where you're coming from and you want a way to do that, you know, we really try to make a good fit for our volunteers to have a really good relationship and a really good time doing what they do.
So let's just remind everybody, if who's listening, where they can go, either to a website or a phone number or an email that you want to give out so that they can connect with you. And, you know, why not just jump on board, help with either the fundraising or, you know, volunteering. I mean, really in any capacity that you can. I know that Susan is ready and happy to accept, you know, your volunteer. So why don't we just remind everybody where to go?
Okay, so the website is www.aokmentor.org, and our phone number is 443-895-2457.
So there you have it. That's how you can get in touch with AOK Mentoring. And again, if you're listening and you feel like, I'm not ready to be a mentor, I'm not ready, because I know that it can be challenging, especially if you're in that younger age group. Maybe you're thinking, I don't even have kids yet. How am I going to sit down and deal with somebody else's child? I understand, because before I was a mom, I also, you know, had certain expectations and ideas of how I was going to be with my children. The moment those children were born, all those ideas went just
out the window,
completely out the window. So we understand, but you may be creative. You may be really good connecting with people, and to be able to create great programs and continue to run great organizations like AOK, it takes a lot of work and a lot of great people. So volunteer, donate, get in touch with AOK Mentoring so that we can continue to work with our children creating a better future for everybody in our community. Susan, thanks again so much for coming into our studio today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And for HOKA Journal, I'm Cris Oviedo, and we'll be right back.
I'm Paul George of the Indiana Pacers. When I was 6, my days were spent playing basketball. When I was 6, my dream was to make it to the NBA. When I was 6, my mom had a stroke. So I want you to learn to spot a stroke fast. F-A-S-T. F, face drooping. A, arm weakness. S, speech difficulty. T, time to call 911. I'm Paul George. Spot a stroke fast. Visit strokeassociation.org. Brought to you by the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Join Mary Weeks and Cris Oviedo on Columbia Matters Radio. Learn all the Columbia Association-related news, events, and programs. Columbia Matters Radio airs every Sunday at 1:30 and Mondays at 9:30. You can take us with you by downloading the Dragon Digital Radio app on the iPhone and Android App Store, or dragondigitalradio.com. www.podbean.com.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
Hamilton was adopted from a rescue in 2008. He really likes to be around people. I get out my mat and I'm doing a downward dog and he's underneath. He's quite the pug about town. He gets invited to a lot of parties. He knows he's a pretty big deal. Look at this little face. How could you not love him?
Hamilton the Pug, Instagram star and shelter pet. Amazing adoption stories start in shelters. Visit theshelterpetproject.org to find a pet near you. Brought to you by Maddie's Fund, the Humane Society of the United States, and the Ad Council.
For HOCO Journal, I'm Alex Baker. For the past few years, I have interviewed the conductor of the Columbia Orchestra, Jason Love, to give us a preview of the upcoming season for the orchestra. Well, a new season is upon us, and it's once again time to look at what they got upcoming for this season. With me here today to talk about it with the Columbia Orchestra again is Jason Love. Mr. Love, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
It was a pleasure having you. So first question we'll just sort of start off with. If this is the first time people have heard our interview and didn't catch the last two, just give us a brief description of what the Columbia Orchestra is.
Okay, well, the fun thing about this particular year is this is our 40th anniversary season.
Oh, wow.
So the orchestra was started 40 years ago. It started out as a tiny little string orchestra. I think some of their early rehearsals were in people's homes, and it was just kind of a way for some of the local musicians to get to keep playing. And gradually over the years, they hired a conductor and started giving public performances, and then about 10 years in, they realized they were ready to become a full symphony orchestra. And now, the Columbia Orchestra we have about 100 members on our roster. They are all volunteer. We play our concerts at the Jim Rouse Theater, which is part of Wild Lake High School, and we do a series every year of four classical concerts and then two different pops concerts, as well as programs for kids, both open to the public, and we even have third graders bust in. So it's become this marvelous orchestra, all volunteer, that does the same kind of stuff that you would be hearing if you lived in New York or LA.
And so how long have you been with the orchestra?
This is actually my 19th year, so it's 40 for the orchestra this year and 20 for me next year.
Almost half the year, pretty much.
Yes. And
half the time, yeah. And so when we talked last time, we went over what you had coming up for the 16-17 year.
Right.
So for those who missed it, give us maybe some highlights of what people missed. What did you feel that was really the highlights?
Wow. Well, one of the really cool recent things was, this was, of course, we're finishing up Columbia's 50th birthday celebration. So we just in June gave a concert. It was an outdoor pops concert on Columbia's birthday, June 21st. And it was a fantastic event because it was at the new Chrysalis Amphitheater in Symphony Woods. And, you know, it was a fantastic thing. We were able to do 1812 Overture and a whole lot of pops and family-friendly stuff. And we had well over 2,000 people there. So that was a really neat way to be part of, you know, such a big community engagement. Some of the things that we've done recently, we did a big concert with the Columbia Pro Cantare, where we did Mahler's Second Symphony with a big chorus. And, you know, we do a lot of mix between really famous classical pieces that it's really great for people to be able to hear live in their own community, along with chamber concerts and newer, frequently cutting-edge works that people would not necessarily be familiar with but get exposed to through our concerts.
And so tell us a little bit about what you had, you know, you're sort of just about ready to start. So what have you been How do you prepare during like the off season? Once the season's over and you're kind of in that in between time, what do you do during that in between time?
Well, you know, it's we're finishing up our brochure for our subscribers to be able to, you know, purchase their tickets for the year, and it's a tremendous amount of scheduling. I mean, we are one of the very busiest community orchestras in the country. So We had all those orchestra concerts. We have 3 chamber concerts. We have a partner in the Columbia Jazz Band, and they do 11 or 12 different events throughout the course of the season. So we are sitting around scheduling and going over calendars and all sorts of things. So the concerts are thinner in the summer, but the administrative stuff is chugging right along.
Yeah, and I remember the Columbia Jazz Band, as you helped me set up that interview. Yeah, they're a great interview too.
Yeah, and they're a great group, and they have an exciting year planned.
And you know, we'll just talking about the off season, we'll dive right into the season. So first one I noticed coming up on your calendar is Sibelius and Chaplin. I think you're doing orchestral parts of some old Chaplin movies.
Well, yes. Yeah, so because this is our 40th anniversary, we wanted to commission a piece, have a composer write a piece to celebrate our anniversary. And when we had our 35th, we had Andrew Earl Simpson, who was a composer at Catholic University, who wrote a score for Buster Keaton's short film, 1 Week. And so we showed the film and played the score, and it was so popular that we thought, well, this is actually an anniversary for Charlie Chaplin's Mutual films, these, you know, short 20-ish minute films. So we he would do a score for The Immigrant, which is one of these 20-minute films. And so he's written a new score, and when I say it is hot off the press, I mean he finished orchestrating it 4 days ago. So we're still getting the parts in, and I will be feverishly learning it. So yeah, we're able to show the film on the big screen while the orchestra plays along live, yeah.
So with an event like that, is it different, like when you know you have the movie playing and then you're doing the orchestral music in the background? Is it different when you're just doing a regular concert?
Yeah, well, you know, we try to incorporate different kinds of experiences, and we've done several sort of multimedia things throughout the course of the season. We have a few other things planned, but that's one of the great things about this orchestra is you get both really the traditional. I'm going to hear a full symphony by Sibelius in concert with an orchestra where I can really watch the oboe player and hear all the subtle nuances because I'm there in the room, but also these things where we have just very different kinds of experiences too.
And then the next one on the list is Symphonie Fantastique. So tell us a little about that.
Yeah, so that's one of these marvelous romantic symphonies. Hector Berlioz, this French composer, and it was one of the major what we call program works, where the piece itself has a literal story. And you know, when he wrote it, it was very the idea of opium eating was very fashionable. This is like the early 1800s, and there was a famous book, Confessions of an Opium Eater. So it was like a vogue topic. So the idea of this symphony is this poet falls in love with this woman, but she doesn't return his advances. So he decides to commit suicide by eating opium, and it's not successful. So he ends up having all these hallucinations, and the piece is like this. So it's a quintessential romantic sort of poet, you know, dreaming up these things, and it's become really one of those very top 20 classical favorites because the music is so vivid and colored, inspired, and even whether or not you know the story, it's, you know, it's an exciting journey.
And then the next one on the list I see is Beethoven and Brahms.
Yes, yeah, so this is one of those fun programs that we do. We have two of the three Bs alongside a new work by a relatively new work by a composer named Ruby Fulton, who was in Baltimore. She's just moved out of the area, but she is a composer and plays in her own band, and she wrote this work for the Baltimore Symphony and Shodake, who is a beatboxer. And so it's actually based on the concept of a particular kind of chess game, and I think we're deciding if we're going to work in some of the visual elements of the chess game actually. And so he beatboxes live with the orchestra, and of course we're pairing that with Beethoven Third Piano Concerto with Ina Falix, who's this marvelous she actually attended Peabody and won the very prestigious Yale Gordon competition there, and that's where we first met her and had her play when she right after that won that competition. And now we bring her back for Beethoven's Third Piano Concerto, which is you know, are just a really fantastic piece, and then Brahms' Second Symphony as well. So it's a great mix of the new and the familiar.
Yeah, mixing kind of or that kind of music with like a beatbox. That, I imagine that must be a bit of a challenge when you're practicing and rehearsing it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not something I've done before. And as a matter of fact, he is trying to always keep his art very fresh. So he's working with Ruby to kind of redo his part so he can bring something else new to it. And I think we're even going to have him kind of demo some things with the audience and have a kind of a little thing where they can interact too, so they get a sense of how it all happens.
Okay. And then the next one on the list is Symphonic Pops. And I believe this is what you were talking about earlier. We would play like 1812 Overture.
Yeah, well, so now we have just starting back up this past season, we have our Pops concerts at the Rouse Theater. And they typically sell out. So this year we've expanded it to a Saturday evening and a Sunday afternoon. It's a great mix of film scores. Like, I know Jurassic Park is coming out around that time, so we're probably going to do some of that music. And some great Broadway stuff. This year we're doing a Rodgers and Hammerstein set and a Stephen Sondheim set. And then we play, you know, some popular songs and even light classics. So it's a great mix that's very family friendly. It's a lot of shorter pieces, so for kids it's not like a 45-minute symphony that you sit through. And we keep them very fun and informal. So we'll have that. And then at the end of the year, actually, we're planning to go back to the Chrysalis in June and do an outdoor Pops. And that'll be kind of an annual thing with 1812 and a whole mix of other stuff as well.
And you're talking a lot about like movie scores and even mixing it with musicals. Like a movie I just saw not too long ago that I really liked was La La Land. So I'd be wondering if you might be incorporating any music from that into it.
Yeah, you know, we're actually looking at that. We may either put some of that live, or there's even a deal where you can perform that live with the film. So if we might be able to do that at some point. So we're working on the logistics of that. You know, the marvelous thing is there's a lot of new reinvigoration in downtown. So we've been, you know, having a lot of discussions with Meriwether and Chrysalis to be able to expand some of these things, to be able to do some neat new things because of all these new opportunities that are coming up.
Okay. And then last one I have on my list is The French Connection. Now, I don't think this is going to be the Best Picture winner from 71.
No, this one's a little bit different. So this is Ravel's Bolero is probably one of the most famous French pieces. And it's a great piece to, you know, hear live in concert. But we're pairing it with one of his other pieces, which is he wrote a ballet called Daphnis and Chloe. And the finale of that ballet is just one of the very great, one of my very favorite pieces. It's this lush, beautiful French music that starts, it has this sort of sunrise and beautifully orchestrated and ends with this big sort of Bacchanalian celebration. And so we picked some other French things to go along with it. Debussy's Prelude to the Afternoon of Faun is a very standard, famous kind of French work, but we've never actually performed it live since I've been there, as well as The Sorcerer's Apprentice, which people know well from the Disney, from Fantasia.
Okay.
So it's a great mix of a bunch of different kinds of French things.
And so those were the ones I saw listed on your website. Are there any others that you're in the process of trying to do for this coming season?
Yeah, so we're adding events all the time. You know, that's part of what happens in the summer is we're making all of the arrangements. I mean, actually, one of the it's marvelous to have the Jim Rouse Theater here in town. One of the challenges is, of course, it's part of a high school, so we have to wait until the academic school's calendar is finished before we can actually start booking the dates. So we're still feverishly putting together our series, which includes. We have three great chamber music concerts. They're Sunday afternoons at 3:00. And the first of them is actually one that I do. We have the Columbia Orchestra Piano Trio, our concertmaster, the first chair violinist, and our orchestra's pianist and I do a full concert of trio. And then we'll have two more throughout the year in February and June where members of the orchestra will sort of curate a little concert with different kinds of trios and quartets and large ensemble pieces.
And so you were talking about the high school, so it kind of leads into one of my next questions. Tell a little bit about some of the educational opportunities you have at the Columbia Orchestra. Like, for example, do you ever collaborate anything here at HCC?
Yes, yes. So we have a fantastic, for grown-ups, one of the HCC faculty, Bill Scanlon-Murphy, comes and does a pre-concert talk and discusses the music with the audience before the concert. So the concerts start at 7:30, and he does a talk from 6:30 to 7:15. And luckily, our seating is reserved seating, so you don't have to be panicked for not getting a good seat because you're at the pre-concert talk. And he's a really, he's a particularly fascinating individual, so those are highly recommended. And we have a whole range of educational things. I mean, for grown-ups at the regular concerts, I actually discuss the pieces and play examples of them during the concert rather than you just show up and they hurl a bunch of music at you. It's very interactive between the orchestra and the audience. But of course, we have a lot of stuff for kids. On Saturdays, this year it's in March, we'll have and that will go up on our website. We have two morning concerts for kids, and that involves our friends from Dance Connections. We like to do a lot of collaborations with other arts groups here. They're marvelous dancers, young dancers, this Dance Connection, and this year we're doing Saint-Saëns Carnival of the Animals. So for even really young kids, it's very easy to follow along, fun thing. Behind the scenes, I think I alluded to, we have concerts that we do for third graders here in Howard County that's tailored to the third grade curriculum. They're done. The kids are bussed into Rouse Theater. We do two. And of course, this is a volunteer orchestra, so people are literally taking off work during the middle of the day to come and play for these kids because we think it is so very important. And we do, and on that French Connection concert, we'll be featuring the winners of our young artist competition. So we have between 40 and 50 kids. There's a lot of phenomenal young musicians here. I mean, well above average, you know, in your for communities across the U.S. So the kids that play in this competition are very professional sounding players. So we're thrilled to be able to feature a couple of them on our concerts during the course of the year.
Yeah, it's good that, you know, you have these opportunities, you know, for younger people, just because I think from experience myself, when I was like 7 or 8, and you played something like from a symphony, I felt like, oh, is this something I got to get through for music classes? I would rather listen to, you know, whatever's on the radio.
Right.
But I do like the fact that, you know, once you open people up, you realize it is this great amount of music.
Well, that's the fun thing about our audience is that we have, it's a range of, people have a range of experience with music. There are some people that are also going to National Symphony and Baltimore Symphony concerts. There are some people who just have a huge classical CD collection, but a significant part of our audience, what classical music is what we're introducing them to, that that they're there because it's a local group that they want to support. And so we're trying to provide the concerts in a context where people really can have a great connection to this stuff, because we're very excited about everything that we play. We don't play that many concerts, so I really stick to the A-list stuff. And so whether it's doing something that's visual, like a movie that they watch, or a chess game, you know, follow a chess game or a story, or whether it's just demonstrating parts, things to listen to and discussing with the audience, you know, I think people are really value this as an experience to make real strong connections with great music.
Mm-hmm. And one thing I noticed, I know on your website, do you still do open rehearsals?
Yes, we're still putting together the calendar for that. And that's been really fantastic. We rehearse at the Gathering Place in Clarksville. So it's actually sort of a large kind of ballroom scenario where we can have people not only sit in and watch an actual working rehearsal, but we provide it's big enough space that they can actually sit in the orchestra, sit next to the flute player or whatever, where they would ordinarily never get to see. You know, when you go to concerts, you never get to see you only see the conductor's behind, you know, so you can actually see what's going on. Usually when orchestras do open rehearsals, it's frequently the dress rehearsal. So it's almost like a concert. But for us, we do it midway through the process, so you're really seeing the sausage get made. I think I've even had some people say, I think I like these more than the concerts. I'm like, no. so they've become very popular, and it is interesting. Awesome. If you've never been in that process.
And so, again, close to my questions here, one thing I'll have to ask you is, if you could narrow it down to just one thing, what do you enjoy most about the Columbia Orchestra?
Wow, that's an excellent question. I mean, to be honest, you know, I have conducted youth orchestras and summer camps, and this is a community orchestra that's a volunteer orchestra. I've conducted big professional orchestras like the Baltimore Symphony, and, you know, so in contemporary music, small ensembles, I played in string quartets. The thing that's very fascinating about the Columbia Orchestra is that because they're not the New York Philharmonic, where they've been doing this, everybody's played this piece 600 times, they are at a place where they are at a high artistic level, but it is still very fresh and new to them, and they're enthusiastic. I mean, some of them are playing some of these pieces for the first time, and that kind of enthusiasm and energy is very infectious. It's not people who are burned out of doing this. Another Beethoven 5, I played this 175 times. So there's a real sense of discovery. And on the other side of the stage of that, a lot of the audience is not hearing the stuff and sick to death of it. So there's a real sense of freshness, and that's very exciting and keeps me interested.
It never feels routine for anybody.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, even though the schedule is always the same and a lot of the people are always the same, and I try to make the kinds of artistic experiences, that's one thing that's death for an artist, when you only learn X number of pieces and you get really good at them, and so there you can do exciting things, but we're constantly trying to challenge ourselves to do new experiences that not only keeps the orchestra growing and fresh and high quality, but keeps the audience like, wow, I got to see what that where that leads.
Awesome. So we're getting close to my questions here. Is there anything I forgot to talk about or anything else you want to bring up?
Well, you've asked all the great questions. I mean, one of the fantastic things about this orchestra is how accessible it is. We have... luckily, it's not like going into a hard area. I mean, you can park right there. It's easy to get to, and to be honest, because it's a volunteer orchestra, it's not ridiculously expensive. So it's easy to bring your entire family, and it's a kind of experience that, you know, a middle school kid is still going to like. So the accessibility of it makes it really a community orchestra in the best sense.
All right. Then last question I'll have is just tell us where listeners can go to learn more about the Columbia Orchestra.
Great. Yeah. So our website is columbiaorchestra.org. And you can also call our office with questions at 410-465-8777.
Okay. Now in its fourth decade, the Columbia Orchestra continues to perform not only the masterworks of the classical repertoire, but also works by today's new generation of composers. They are ready to kick off their 2017 to 2018 season to give Columbia a number of memorable performances. I have been talking today with the conductor of the Columbia Orchestra, Jason Love, to discuss more about this upcoming season. Mr. Love, I want to thank you again for coming on the show today.
Thanks so much for having me in. I really enjoyed it.
Always a pleasure having you. For Hoko Journal, I'm Alex Baker, and we'll be right back on Dragon Digital Radio.
In the small town of Elmira, New York, a boy was born into an all-American family. The odds of him achieving his dream in the fashion industry? 1 in 23 million. The odds of having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 68. I am Tommy Hilfiger, and my family is affected by autism. Learn more at autismspeaks.org/signs. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council.
Teen Health Matters, airing every Tuesday at 5:30 and Sunday at 12 noon on Dragon Digital Radio.
And one of the things that I hold as a tenet is that every young person deserves to have, as a right, an activated and engaged adult throughout childhood, adolescence, and into young adulthood.
You can take us with you by downloading Dragon Digital Radio on the iPhone and Android App Store.
You know what really gets a party started? Indoor baseball. Yeah, just find a broom or a pool cue, and you can use, like, anything as a ball. Cans, bottles, shoes.
Hey, bro, toss me that avocado.
Most party fouls are pretty dumb, but if you decide to drink and drive underage, you could lose your license and your freedom. Underage drinking and driving, the ultimate party foul. Learn more at ultimatepartyfoul.org. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
That's it for our show today. Thanks to our producers and guests, not only for taking the time to speak with us, but also for all you do to make our community a more musical place and for investing in educating our children for the future. Don't forget to connect with us through social media. Like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, and check out our brand new Instagram page. You can find us under Dragon Digital Radio. Visit our website and check out our podcast page where you can find this episode of Hoka Journal and share it with your friends and family. Just go to dragondigitalradio.podbean.com. If you would like to come in and share your story, contact me, Cris Oviedo, at moviedo@howardcc.edu, or connect with me via Facebook at my Cris Oviedo page or through Dragon Digital Radio. Stay healthy, happy, positive, and blessed. And remember the words of Cheryl Lavender: the fact that children can make beautiful music is less significant than the fact that music can make beautiful children. Until next month, I am Cris Oviedo.